All right. Good evening. I'm Vern Paxson from the International Computer Science Institute here in Berkeley, in the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, just up from UC Berkeley. And I'm also an adjunct at Berkeley. And while I won't be talking about it, just to give you some context, I'm also Stefan Savage's co-director of the Internet Epidemiology Center. So a lot of what I spend my time on is worms, and the other part is network intrusion detection. Watching network traffic to analyze what we see in the way of attacks and other activities. So, all right. What I'm going to cover is a bit on what are we trying to do with this technology. I think you've already gotten tastes of that from your other lectures, as I gather. What is the appeal of the particular approach? What are sort of different styles that are used to detect attacks? A little on how do you build such a system, if there's time. I'll have to figure that out. I want to talk about, Stefan alluded to this at the very end of his talk, about the problem of evasion, which is sort of a deep problem with the whole approach. And also, time permitting, I want to talk a little about some algorithms for detecting activity. So this is a lot higher level notion than the art is usually practiced. Stefan talked very briefly about the notion of detecting scanners. I'd like to look at that and also stepping stones. It's really important to keep in mind that there's no crisp notion of what is the problem we're trying to solve in terms of, we all agree what's good and bad. In fact, it's crucial to understand what's deemed your threat model. What is it you're trying to protect? And this varies from entity to entity. And another crucial thing is what resources do you have to try to protect that? And then the third, which is sort of the part of threat and threat model, is who is trying to get you? And all this then boils down to trade-offs of resources, not to, let's bulletproof this system, but rather how do we spend what resources we got to protect the things we deem important from the people we believe are the problem going after us. So this means we're talking policy just in a deep way, and it's going to change from different sites' perspectives. Okay. Classically, threats are thought about in two types, insiders and outsiders, where insiders are people who are inside your system in the sense of they have some form of legitimate access, and then they're abusing that access. These folks are historically very hard to detect. They know too much, and they've got already a presumption of access allowed to them. And so you cannot use the mere fact that they're accessing something as a flag to say they're problematic. And they can really cause damage, again, because they already have access. These folks, in a lot of contexts, appear to be rare. Okay, the vendors, particularly those who sell technology that purports to address this threat, like to say, no, these are really common. But as far as I can tell, none of that is well substantiated. And in fact, from a computer security perspective, these are rare, and in many contexts, they're not an integral part of the threat model. They're not a deep part of it. And I'm not going to talk much more about them. Then you got your outsider threat. Attacks from entities that have no legitimate access. As doubtless you've already heard in lectures, attacks from over the internet are just ubiquitous. It's just constantly happening. And in fact, we did a study of what we call the internet background radiation, which is you just take a single post on the internet, or in fact a single address. We did this with the network telescope, Stefan mentioned. It's probed every 90 seconds on average. Now, that number has a lot of variation from where you are just how you define a probe and so forth. But that's basically the right number. And there was another number published fairly recently about taking 4 minutes for an unpatched machine to get infected with a worm once it was connected to the internet. So this is the outsider threat baseline. It's just out there, and it's constantly banging on your door. Another way to frame this, at a medium-sized site, namely the Lawrence Berkeley Lab, with a definition of scanner that relates to the detecting activity in scanners that I'll talk about later, with that definition, sees tens of thousands of scanners a day. Different hosts all scanning. What are they looking for? They're basically probing for services that have vulnerabilities that can then be used to inject code in some fashion or just to miscontrol the server in order to take to gain access to it. A whole lot of what these remote scanners are what you might call auto-routers, or they're toolkits that attackers run from hosts they've already compromised to go find more hosts to compromise. Strictly speaking, they're not worms, meaning if they find a host and gain access to it, they don't self-propagate to it. They merely report that fact or install a backdoor that the controller of the scan operation can then go and use at a later time. But some of them do self-propagate, and those, by definition, are worms. Another part of this outsider threat to keep in mind is that it's very easy to fixate on that, yes, it comes over the internet because such a volume does, but in fact, increasingly today, it comes through the front door in laptops that are infected or home machines that have preferred network access into a site and so forth. So this notion of a perimeter between what's outside and what's inside is eroding, and that's a headache. Another part of this is sort of the standard threat model, not everybody's threat model. What are these attackers looking for? And it's not us. I mean, they generally, for many sites, the model is they're not being specifically targeted. They're just being opportunistically targeted. Historically, a lot of these attackers from the background radiation sort of nature, we're looking essentially for bragging rights, or vandals and the like. This is shifting, and as Stefan related, they now more and more look for zombies, machines that they can control and then either use themselves directly to launch attacks, send out spam, or to rent to other people. As long as you're in this world, the damage that these attacks cause is limited to cleanup. Mm-hmm. You know, the attacks are not causing deep damage. All of this is changing, though, and this last is, you know, this is really a crucial point that this, let me try this gadget. Oh, there we go. Commercialization of malware is really scary from a network security perspective, because the evolution of attacks, network attacks, over the last 10, 15 years of the internet has been slow. It is very plausible that the ability to make money is going to change that. It's going to accelerate the innovation that attackers show. And there's clear signs this is already happening. Okay, so that's, you know, the some motivation about why we might want to watch these networks and see what's coming in over them. Let me talk about how one does this. Just about all of the traffic out there that's crossing a network link is unencrypted. So you can just look at it and read it. Now, this changes slowly, and in certain contexts, much more of it's encrypted. But to first order, you can look at it. Furthermore, the communication that goes by is all very highly structured in layers. And these layers have agreed upon meanings, standards, and so forth, and therefore, by interpreting what you see, given what layer it's at and the like, you can build up what the communication is between the sender and the receiver just by looking at the traffic between them. These layers come from the individual packets that are the unit of data routed through the internet. into connections, which, you know, established flows of packets that live for a while, and up to sessions, which are collections of connections that amount to a sort of aggregate activity like web surfing. So you can look at this traffic and you can understand what it's trying to achieve, and you can do it in real time. So you can do it as it flies by, more or less. I'll talk about that in a bit. Now, a really important thing to understand is that the appeal here of watching these links, a lot of it is rooted in the fact that it's cheap. Right? You can, by watching a link, that particularly when there's a choke point between a bunch of things you care about and a bunch of threat, you can, with one monitor, take care of trying to detect attacks against hundreds, thousands of hosts. So you save a whole lot of money as opposed to monitoring each host individually, or you save a whole lot of management headache. In addition, there's nothing to say you have to only watch with one box. You can put multiple boxes on to spread load, or you can distribute boxes all around to look at different links simultaneously. Another sometimes nice thing about this technology is, in general, you cannot detect that it's deployed out there. There are exceptions, but I'm not going to have time to go into. And then a side effect, and one that, in fact, is good to keep in mind, is that if it's a system that does a lot of logging and, in fact, can provide a lot of insight into your non-attack activity, just how your network is used. And I'm always struck at how companies, for example, that do some sort of security monitoring and build up some sort of visibility in the network inevitably find they have a lot of clients who just want the visibility and are not particularly care about their security technology. Maybe they've got some other story about how they take care of that problem. But just the visibility is really of a lot of interest. Okay, so that's why it's appealing to watch this traffic fly by. And then there are some problems. So if you're just watching, then you're passive. You can only react to what you see. You cannot prevent what you see. Now, I'll talk in a little bit about how do you prevent it. But in general, in the simple model of you're watching traffic, well, you're watching. You're not stopping. In addition, this technology can be a bit beguiling because it's so cheap to deploy in a lot of ways, in that it assumes that the network link you're looking at is indeed where your problem is. So it has an implicit threat model associated with it, and it might be easy or to lose sight of the fact that that may be the wrong threat model. There are performance issues. This is hard to do on today's high-speed links, and on today's very high-speed links, doing this in a useful way is really hard. Okay, so it, the you know how Moore's Law evolves and specialized hardware and network bandwidth, I mean, they're all in a race, and at any given time, you can or cannot measure what's really fast. There's also a subtle issue that is termed vantage point, meaning you're not really seeing the connection as experienced by the sender or the receiver. You're seeing something in between. And when I talk a bit about this evasion point, I'll return to that, the fact that you don't see the exact communication. And in fact, this can be a deep problem if you want to watch inside the network, not net right at its edge, but you want to watch traffic in the large, because very often you only see one direction of any given connection. You don't see both. That's how internet routing tends to work. And that complicates this problem of disambiguating what you're seeing. Okay, let me just... Good. So now let me talk about ways of, you know, classes of approaches for detecting attacks. What I'll sketch here is not particular to network intrusion detection. It's for intrusion detection in general, however one does it. The question is, how do you automate looking for attacks in various fashions? Because you definitely want to automate it given the volume of what's going on. So the sort of simplest approach, and the one that is heavily flogged by the commercial world, is what's called signature-based. The idea is, well, you know about all these attacks, and you codify What does it look like if such an attack happens to go by on the wire you're monitoring? And if you ever see it, that's an alarm. That's the notion. So here in this ugly stuff is a signature from the Snort freeware intrusion detection system. It's the popular signature-based system out there. And it doesn't really matter other than just give you the flavor of what it's doing. So it's saying, you know, if it's TCP traffic, so it's, you know, the reliable connection-oriented traffic from the outside to the inside to that particular port, and therefore we assumed a particular type of service, even though it's not guaranteed. And it's going from a client to a server, and they established a connection. So there's a bunch of notions that the connection has achieved a certain state, has a certain bit of properties. And then, and here's the signature, we see all those bytes right in a row. Okay? That's somewhere in the packet. Then this is bad. This is the Linux Samba overflow. And in fact, it's been codified in 1999 as the 811th vulnerability scene and alarm. Right? So that's the notion. And you can see how that's not conceptually very hard to build a gadget to do that. Right? It just checks the conditions, searches for the string. Maybe you got some fancy hardware that finds the string fast for you, and you're done.
So is it doing this on an enterprise basis or on a host basis?
All of what I'm talking about, you're watching a link, and just about always there's a bunch of hosts behind it, not just one. But you could do it with just one. Is that the question, really?
Yeah. So there's a high-speed box watching the wire.
Yeah. That's the usual thing here. Though a whole lot of this applies to a single, you know, even on your own host watching your network traffic. A lot of these issues are the same. Okay. And you can do these signatures. They don't have to be on the, you know, what exactly are the bytes in the packet. You could have a signature and what's the URL or web request. And however you get the URL, then you're going to do the signature match. But the key notion is you define exactly this is an attack. The good thing about this approach is these things are easy to understand, and they're easy to write up usually when you've seen an attack, providing the attack is not polymorphic, doesn't change each instance. And in particular, you can build up libraries and share them. The Snort system comes with a library of more than 2,000 signatures, things to look for. The bad thing is you cannot detect anything that you don't have a signature for. So anything new, even if it's a variant, you're just going to miss. And another bad thing, which I should have on here but don't, is it often is very hard to write a crisp signature, one that will only see bad things and will not complain about good things. Okay, a whole other approach, really different in thinking and harder to put together, is called anomaly detection. And here the idea is not I'm going to look for exactly the XYZ attack, but instead a statistical notion, which is attacks are weird. And I'm going to look for weird things. And in particular, in anomaly detection, what you do is you build up profiles of what is normal. Generally, you do this using machine learning. And so you have some training period where you munch on logs of activity, and you build up this notion of normal. And then you're going to look for deviations, and those are going to be the things you alarm on. So this is predicated on the assumption that what you define as normal is an envelope that is pretty good at encapsulating indeed what is normal and pretty crisp at things outside that really are problems worth alarms. So the example here, user Joe only logs in from host A and usually at night. So this is something that conceptually an anomaly detection system might learn. It just looks at the logs and says, well, given that user ID, I never see it other than A, and it's usually at night, so I'll assign some probability to it being nighttime. Now, this can work if, in particular, you have that tight envelope, which is usually means you do it in a domain that's pretty narrowly defined. And like the content sifting that Stefan talked about is a form of anomaly detection, and it turns out it's one of these narrowly defined domains where, in fact, What's in the envelope is just about all of your normal traffic, and what's outside is things that are problematic. The scan detection that I hope to talk about also has this property. Yeah.
All right. If worms are really common, how does that work? Like, don't they look normal? If you're going to get infected on an unpatched machine in 4 minutes.
So the question is, if worms are so common, don't they look normal? And that's exactly this problem down here, that these systems can, unfortunately, if you've got attacks in your training set, will learn that that's normal. Yep. So that's a basic problem with this approach. So the good thing about this is you can detect all sorts of attacks, because you're looking not for the attack itself, but for a behavior it manifests, namely, it's something peculiar, it's weird. And including attacks that no one's ever seen, you can still find this way. And the problem, the con is, of course, you can also miss an enormous amount of attacks, including those that are codified in those big signature words, because they happen to be inside the envelope. Okay, there's a third style that has emerged in, I would say, the last 5 years or so, called specification-based. And I'm a fan of this over the other two. And the notion here is, you don't learn what's normal. You declare what's allowed. Okay? So you write a specification of this is what's allowed, or a specification of this is definitely not allowed. And then you look at your activity and look for things that violate the specification. So recall in the previous slide, it was user Joe only logs in from host A, usually at night, a thing we learned. And here, it's user Joe is only allowed to log in from host A. And there's no day or night, because it turns out, and I'm just hypothesizing, that when you specify this, you don't really care whether it's day or night. What matters to the policy is it had better be from host A. Now, what's good about this is you get the same sort of properties as anomaly detection in that you're looking for a behavior manifested by an attack has occurred, as opposed to the attack itself. So you can find all sorts of attacks, including things you've never seen before. You can also, to some degree, accommodate the other styles in this one. You can, signatures can be things that are definitely not allowed by the policy, and anomalies can, anomaly detection technology can suggest what might be the specifications you should define, right? You might have had the anomaly detection thing learn that user Joe seems to only log in from A, and then say, oh yeah, that ought to be the policy. Another plus is security is a policy, and this is a direct way of saying, let's think about what is your policy and enforce it. The big problem is that it turns out in practice these policies are huge and they're a big, big headache. They're a big headache to specify, a big headache to get right, and then there's churn. There's the fact that constantly a site's actual policy, fine-grained, which this generally needs to be, is changing. New users come, new machines come, new services come, there's different business priorities, whatever, and so you've got to maintain these specifications. And okay, and then I should say, and that's it. That's the technology available in the art for automatically detecting attacks. Okay, whether you're looking at network links or at what's happening on the host, wherever, those are the three classes.
Hey, Bert?
Yeah?
What obligations do you owe your authorized users to let them know the extent to which you're monitoring their behavior?
I missed the key word. What something do you do with your authorized users to let them know that you're monitoring them?
What disclosures do you owe them, or what notification do you owe them about the extent to which you're monitoring their behavior in order to detect anomalies?
There are significant legal issues just in general on to what degree can you watch them.
Right.
And this varies from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. I don't know any particular exemptions for building up profiles as opposed to just seeing what they're doing anyway. You know, the ability to read their email, it's very sensitive, and in general you need something in place that says, yes, you have a right to do that, and they've, in many jurisdictions, they've been informed you can do that. But this really varies. You know, and there are other countries where you cannot keep logs that have identifying information. It's just not legal. and others where there's no such quality. Okay, so let me sort of summarize here before going on to some technology. So I've made this point about this theme, security is about policy. I mean, I think that's really important to keep in mind. And with it comes this notion of risk management. We're not building bulletproof things. We're trying to get the job done with what we have at hand. This next is really crucial, all right? All intrusion detection systems, and here the all is, it's a system, not a specific algorithm. Some algorithms don't have this, but almost all of it. But the systems all do, have these key problems of false positive, false negative. False positive is you alarm when you shouldn't have. False negative is you fail to alarm when you should have. Okay? And there is essentially no way to just fundamentally get rid of this problem. Instead, you're always trading it off. You're deciding, what will I tolerate in terms of bad alarms versus missed alarms? Right? So that's, again, going to be a policy decision. It's going to relate to, well, what does an alarm cost? What does a break-in cost? And what do I think, for whatever technology I'm using, the ratio between those that it's going to give me? So this is a huge headache. Another important point is that as things get big, they get diverse. It's just a general rule. And it means that when you figure out how to do some detection problem in the small, it does not at all mean it will work in the large. Right? And this is particularly plagues researchers who go off and analyze a sort of pinpoint instance of a problem and decide how to detect it and try it out on their LAN of their lab. And yes, it works for those 20 hosts, and it completely fails for 2,000 hosts. And it generally fails either just due to, you know, usual system scaling properties, it takes too much memory or it's n squared or whatever, but also for this notion of diversity. The traffic is weirder than you expect as things get big. And then I think it's good to have this sort of mental model, just where the state of the art is, which I would say is like car alarms. You know, they're useful. They're, you know, what you can get out there today and what you deploy, it's useful. It'll go off often when someone's attacking you. But it will not always go off. And particularly if they're good, it very well may not. And it goes off quite a bit when there's no reason for it to go off. And this last is this Achilles heel problem I talked about, a false positive. And where this really burns you is that it trains the analyst who gets these alarms to ignore them. Right? Every time the alarm goes off, if their job is, you know, we'll figure out if it's an important one and fix it if it is, every time it's not an important one, they get a little more disinterested in listening to the next one. This is a very real problem.
So, Bernd, I know the University of Washington spends a lot of energy detecting when it's being used to launch attacks as opposed to when it's being attacked. Is that a significantly different problem?
No, it's actually very similar, and I think it's changing. I think it's going to boil down to threat model, right? So the like at the Lawrence Berkeley lab, It's now quite high priority to find when it's being used to launch attacks because LBL's threat model is please avoid bad publicity.
Right.
Right? Do not get on the radar at Washington as a lab that has a security problem. That is really, really high up in the threat model.
Right.
Significantly above it costs, you know, $N thousand to clean up.
You forgot the word again.
Yeah. Well, so... So, you know, I believe, you know, increasingly universities are finding that the heat they get means they do need to look for internal compromise. And in California, there's, what is it, SB 12, 4, 13? I can't remember the number. Do you remember the number?
No.
Anyway, it's the state law that you must let people know when their confidential information has been compromised, or potentially compromised off a computer. And that is really expensive. So the, you know, the last such incident in Berkeley, I don't know the exact number, but I know it was in the hundreds of thousands of dollars.
The last such instance at the University of Washington was when a laptop got stolen from the development office and they had to call all their major donors to tell them that their credit card information was gone.
So that happened in Berkeley too, and in fact, I heard anecdotally it cost Berkeley a significant donation, you know, which significant I'm sure means many, many zeros. Okay, so let's see. I think I'm going to skip over how these things are structured, and the, you know, the punchline being you can layer it, you filter to reduce the volume, and you try, and a key thing is you try to decouple decoding, which is what, according to the, let me back up there, decoding, which is what is the policy neutral elements of what you're seeing. You know, this is a connection. This is a web request. This is a reply. You know, no policy, no judgment about whether it's good or bad. You decouple that from the detection, that way, how you decide I care about this particular activity. You want them separate. You want them separate for a lot of reasons. A big, big one is because you want this system to be able to adapt to your changing policy. You want other people to use it with different policies. You want to recognize that the decoding part has to evolve. This must evolve because the internet applications evolve all the time, and the detection do. And you want them decoupled if you can. Okay. Now, the last point I want to make here, though, and it's a segue, I'm thinking of the next slide. Let me check. Yep. Is when you do your detection is also when you can then take action. Okay? You don't needn't just say, oops, you got a problem, but you can, in fact, do something about it. And an important one that I'm not going to have more time to talk about is record forensic information. And in particular, the system I work on is called Bro. It logs every single connection it sees, whether or not it's good or bad. It logs it. And for any application that understands that, it logs the application dialog. You know, here was the URL. Here was the response code. Here was the size of the item that came back. Here was its, you know, type, all that stuff. And you know, this can have a lot of utility for just this insight into your traffic that I talked about earlier. But also, when you have an actual problem, you realize, oh, geez, it's been broken into. This is invaluable, so you can figure out how bad was it. Okay, because often the machine that gets broken into is no help at all. If the attacker is sophisticated, they've covered their tracks well. Okay, so you can, as you detect things, you can you record information about them, and then you can generate these alarms. You know, hey, operator, wake up. And you can actually go off and do stuff. Act. All right. And when you do stuff to prevent the attack, now you're in a different space. And indeed, the industry has adopted the term intrusion prevention as opposed to intrusion detection, somewhat just as a marketing play. But this is a huge win, right? Now you can stop the damage from happening. And depending on what that damage costs you, it can be enormously beneficial to stop it, make sure it doesn't happen. On the other hand, if you screw up, then you've just disrupted legitimate traffic. You make the wrong decision. And so, you got to trade off. What's your threat model? What's your false positive, false negative line? There's various ways to do this. You can just fool the connection, which is by faking up traffic that says, oh, the other side just wants to tear down this connection, even though it's a lie. You can talk with the firewall or router at the border and say, throw this traffic away, please. Now, an important issue here is there's a race condition, which is you've got to detect it. And that takes at least, you know, well, it takes cycles, and generally milliseconds. particularly since there's buffering in these systems. When you look at something big, there's quite a bit of buffering. So it takes milliseconds to figure this out. And more traffic has flown by while you're figuring it out. More traffic flies by while you talk to the router and say, hey, it's me, here's my cert, you remember, yes, it really is me, you know, so forth. And so there's a race condition whether or not you'll prevent things. This has led to this push towards inline elements, meaning the intrusion detection system itself must forward a packet or it's not going to make it to its recipient. So the inline approach is very powerful because the race condition is away. You're able to immediately block attacks. However, now you've got another element in your forwarding path, and not only is it in just an element, you know, another box whose power supply can fail, but it's this big, complicated element. It's doing all this analysis and making these decisions. So the performance issues, can you do this fast enough, and the robustness issues, can you do it without making the network brittle, are significant. Okay, I need to talk a bit about evasion. I'm going to do this example, which is the sort of simpler one, and I'll skip the next one. So consider this URL, which happens to be one of a zillion attacks that we see in actual traffic. And we're going to scan for this. We want to see this when this occurs. So say we're looking for the command.exe. Okay, that seems easy. The example I'm going to skip says even that is hard, but that seems easy. But now check out this URL. This flies by, and it's the same except for that little thing there. What is that? Well, that's an escape sequence that's allowed by the HTTP standard that says stick in there not %64, but the ASCII, the character whose ASCII code is 64, which is a D. Okay? So that's how a standard conformant server, when it receives this request, will interpret it. These are equivalent. Okay? Because it'll do this escapist convention. Now, does your monitor do that? If it doesn't, boom, you can be evaded. The attacker just trivially changes their traffic and you don't detect it. This is an example of evasion because you're incomplete in how much you implement. All right? You were a dummy for not doing the escape thing. It's there in the 210-page spec for HTTP. You better do it. Now, all right, we decide, all right, we'll add our module. It's going to do these escapes. And, in fact, these escapes turn out to be hairy. There's all sorts of character sets and stuff. But we do it. Now, this thing flies by. Now, what is this? That is three encoded characters. And what they are is a percent 64. That thing. Okay? So what this thing is, once its standard interpretation is not the attack. It's in fact this precursor to the attack. However, and this is the key thing, some web servers, even though it's not the standard, turns out they will escape their strings twice. And so if you happen to have one of those, it will turn it into that. And if you don't, it won't. So this is the key thing now. Now we've moved away from you were a bozo, you didn't implement the spec, to oops, it's ambiguous. It's ambiguous. There's just no way, however carefully you read that spec, that you can get this right. Because it's not about the spec. It's about that particular server. Now, and the model is the attacker can afford to probe that server and figure out, whoops, that's something. Oh, well.
Carry on.
The model is the attacker can afford to probe the server and figure out which of these it'll do. Now, in this example, you might say, all right, well, but that's really weird to see as, you know, a sequence like that. I'll alarm on that anyway. And the reason that doesn't work, so I'm going to skip over this other lovely example about fundamental network evasion, and go to this, the problem of CRUD. And by CRUD, I mean, and this is one of these, as traffic gets large, as what you're looking at is big, it gets diverse and it gets weird. So real network traffic, when you're looking at a lot of it, has very strange stuff in it. And it's really rare. You know, so it can't, you know, like, oh, it's one in a million. Well, a billion packets go by, there's a thousand of them in there. So you see all this strange stuff. You see, you know, storms of useless packets that are not flooding attacks. There's something's broken in an implementation or even in a protocol. You see addresses that cannot be routed in the internet in internet packets. What are they doing there? You see data split up into pieces that overlap. Now, that's just perverse. When you split up data, it's disjoint. You know, there's just no reason to overlap it. And these, when I'm talking about these are all benign. So I have traces with all of this, and they're benign. You see these standards directly violated. We just talked about that. I like these last two. You see senders who acknowledge data. Yep, I got it. And it was never sent. Okay? They're just broken. And you see senders that retransmit different stuff the second time than the first time. So they get a timeout, they're like, oh, it hasn't been acknowledged. I think the recipient must have lost it, you know, got lost in the network. Here it is again, but it's different. Okay? So these all boil down to ambiguities in various ways when you're watching the network, and you just don't know what this thing means. This is the number from yesterday. So the bro up at LBL, 76,000 weird things, by its definition are weird. And 13 million connections. So the problem is you can't alarm on the weird in general. And this is why evasion gets subtle and is a fundamental sort of problem. Okay, I'm going to skip over approaches for countering this. And suffice it to say that the one that is going to sort of echo into my summary slide is introduce a network element. So there's a whole approach in which you basically clean up the traffic as it goes by. Let's just keep that one in mind. Okay. The last two things I want to talk about before summarizing are detecting activity. And I want to go through this because gives some insight into how one can think in fairly powerful terms about one's traffic and its properties and develop good detection algorithms that are robust in the face of all this high volume, weird stuff, and basically deliver actionable alarms, things that, you know, when they say, I got it, they got it. And I'm only going to do this in high-level terms, give you the flavor of it and to develop a point. So one of these is scanners. How do you tell someone's probing your site? You'd like to know this guy's probing your site. In particular, like the bro at LBL, if you're probing it, it's going to talk to the router and say, throw this bozo away. Do not allow his traffic, any of it, into the site. Okay? And it does this hundreds of times a day. So the question is, how do you do this? How do you determine someone's probing your site? And how do you do it fast so that you can make a decision that's actually going to benefit you, a blocking decision? The way this is classically done is it's very simple notion. You're going to have a window of time, T seconds, and you're going to just count up. That source went to N different places. And so you parameterize it by T and by N, and that's your definition. It's pretty simple. However, the attacker can evade this quite easily if they know T and N or if they can figure it out. And it's also difficult to come up with good numbers that work in practice. And it tends to be that there's the sort of tail end of legitimate traffic is going to connect to N different hosts in T seconds for values of N and T you'd like to use to get aggressive quick detection. So you wind up having to set these high. A quite different approach is leveraging a basic idea. And this was the theme I wanted to get to. And the idea is the scanner doesn't know what's there. That's by definition, right? If they knew what services are out there, they wouldn't bother scanning. So they don't know. And therefore, their attempts are more likely to fail than those of someone who's legit. Now, they won't all fail, but they're more likely to. That's what this approach is going to leverage. Okay, and so the way it works is it casts this in a statistical framework and says, we got two hypotheses. The null hypothesis is this source we're trying to evaluate is benign. And therefore, their connections fail with probability P0. And it turns out in the scheme that we work on this P0s, they fail 20% of the time or less, which is very generous. If you look at what hosts actually do, whole lot of them tend not to fail. 1% would have worked. But that part is not actually all that important. And then the other hypothesis, H1 here, is no, maybe it's a bad guy, in which case he's going to fail more often. And in the statistical framework, it doesn't matter what P0 and P1 are very much. You can detect scanners regardless. But it only impacts how quickly you find it. The P1 we used was 80%. And we can show from our traces that's a reasonable number. Now, as connection attempts come in from the source, you use a framework from statistics called sequential hypothesis testing. And what it means is events are coming, and each time you're trying to decide, is this the event I care about? Can I resolve between these models? Does this new event, which is a connection succeeded or it failed? I'm going to update my statistical information for this source. I'm going to decide, can I declare H0 or H1, or do I not have enough information yet? And so it turns out if you do this, you can find these scanners generally after 4 or 5 connection tests. All it takes to, with in a statistical framework, so you can say, here's the probability of that I'm making a good decision, here's the probability of making a bad decision, you can find these. And that's very fast. Okay, I'm going to have to go to summary. So I skip also the lovely example of step extents and go to these points. Earlier, I already hammered at this notion that we're talking policies, we're talking trade-offs. The motivation for this whole lecture is that, in fact, as you're watching networks of traffic, if you're careful and thoughtful about how you're going to filter it, how you're going to reassemble it, how you're going to interpret that, then you can learn a whole lot of what's going on. But there are a lot of subtle issues to get to that. A point I didn't have any opportunity to go into is that, in fact, state management, when you're doing this, what do you do about the hundreds of megabytes or gigabytes of information you've learned from the past? How do you actually manage it? That's really hard. There's this problem of evasion, which I talked about. And in fact, now that we have commercially motivated attackers, this is going to lead to arms race. Traffic is rife with diversity and junk. That's an important one to keep in mind. It really limits a lot of easy approaches. Another point I didn't go into, but there's increasing tension to use the endpoint host to sit there, and all the ambiguities go away, a whole lot of the performance issues go away. You have this incredible management headache because you got a V on the end host. But you solve a ton of your network-oriented problems. And then finally, this last point, where a lot of this is going is pressure to deploy boxes that are going to massage your traffic or control it in order to help this whole process. And that pressure is really big. So you expect both to see things moving out to the endpoint host and these inline forwarding elements. Both of those are just inevitable in the next few years. So I'm out of time. I don't know if you want to take a question or two. Or
sure. I got a quick collection of questions, Vern. One is, can you talk about, first of all, how well Dro is doing today? That is, at what rate does it detect intrusions, and what portion do you think it detects? How often does it false alarm? Secondly, are you keeping up or falling behind or catching up?
So, quick answers to those. There's never a crisp answer to how well and how many attacks and so forth, in part because so much of it depends on threat model, what's your definition of something you care about, and what are you willing to tolerate? So I can say for the operational deployment there, it generates alarms on the order of, which it really depends on what filtering modules are in place and what analyzers are turned on, but on the order of 50, 100 a day, something like that, that ones that are flagged as, this you should look at. It's generating scan blocking decisions hundreds a day, and those are totally actionable because the laboratory, part of its lifeblood is its high performance networking, is willing to put that in the hands of this gadget and its decisions. So there are elements of it that are highly successful and other elements that are not actionable to that degree. Regarding performance, I have actually two different research projects on hardware assistance to these devices. So it has been the case that a high-end commodity PC could watch a site like LBL's network traffic, and LBL right now is on the order of 10,000 hosts. That is falling by the wayside. And here at UC Berkeley, it's not possible for a commodity PC to do. But a number of them might. But the research focuses on how would you design robust hardware to assist. And obviously, being a researcher, I love to talk about it a bunch. But I will refrain from doing so.
So one more question. An alarm goes off every 15 or 20 minutes. What happens?
So there's actually some post-processing that the analysts do to decide which of those to elevate. And in fact, this has been, to be blunt, this has been frustrating because I believe they could push all that post-processing into Bro and make the decisions in real time. But they're not willing to do that. And I think that's an indication Bro's model is too complicated for an analyst whose job is not to, figure out programming languages, but to take care of security problems. Too complicated for them to bite off. I hope to change that. If the post-processing indicates a problem, then they move. So the only automated, there are only a few things that are automated fully in terms of blocking, and that's the primarily scan detection, certain other attacks. Does that answer what you're looking for?
Yeah, thank you.
Anything else?
Quick question from San Diego.
Go.
Can you go? So with MID systems, there's a number of, let's say, open source projects and a number of commercial products that you can buy. Where is the state of the art?
The state of the art in intrusion detection products?
Yeah.
So, in my view, it is actually, most of it is not such sophisticated technology, in general intrusion detection, as opposed to things going after specific problems. So some of the worm stuff is clever, and some of the, the companies I advise are all doing very clever things. But the most of it is in terms of still signature flavored and much stronger on management, facilitating management. So giving you insight into what you've done, letting you explore these signatures and the like. It's actually a bit discouraging. I would like to make one point on that, which is I think there's this unfortunate property of such systems, which is you generally don't know what you're missing until very late. And so the fact that they may be weak is not highlighted. And it turns out people who use these get a warm, fuzzy feeling from seeing these alarms go off for a while until they have to actually use them in an actionable sense. And so the weaknesses of the signature approach are either masked or give you short-term benefit, even though in the long term I think it's a just fundamentally limited approach. So I would say what you can get today, it will certainly help. It's got to change in the coming years, and it is changing. There's a lot of changes. Is that it?
Yes.
Seems like
Mike, let's thank our speaker.
Thank you.